Hello, my name's Gary. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gary.
He's not nervous because he doesn't have to stand up here. And, real easy for him. I tell you, I'm really honored to be able to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope with the people that I love the most, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is really, really a special weekend for me because I have my daughter with me. She's never heard my story, but she just lived most of it. And it's also special for her because Sunday's her 21st birthday. And I know you guys are saying, well, wait, Gary, you know, you can't be that old. And I just want you to know, that I'm not. I was 3 when I got married and 4 when she was born. But this is really, really special for us, and I really thank you for inviting me. I, too, get real nervous whenever I have to stand in front of one of these things, and I don't know, maybe it's just this microphone or what, but it always makes me really nervous. And so I've got a little story that seems to put me at ease and seems to work out real well for me. And some of you may have heard it, so bear with me. It's a story of 2 American women tourists that go to Scotland to look at the Highland Games. And if you don't know anything about the Highland Games, what it is the native Scotsmen dress up in their traditional kilt, and they have these games where they throw big trees over their shoulders and try to pick up great big rocks and see who can throw them the farthest. They also partake in the native drink, scotch. And so these 2 ladies go over there to watch the games. And the first one that they saw, this one elbows the other one and says, hey, look, those kilts are really neat, but I wonder if they're wearing underwear underneath there. The other one goes, well, I don't know, you know. And, well, can you see? And, no, can't see. And so all day long they tried to catch a glimpse to see if these Scotsmen were wearing underwear or not. They never could see. And so that day the games were ending and they were walking back to the hotel. And up underneath this one tree was a Scotsman laid out, passed out from the partaking of the scotch. And so this one elbows the other one and says, okay, now's your chance. Go look and see. And she says, I can't do that. Somebody will see me. And she says, no, don't worry. I'll stand here and watch and make sure nothing happens. And so she says, okay. So she goes running up there and she throws back the kilt. And sure enough, he doesn't have on any underwear. And she goes, come, look. And so this one looks back and forth, up and down the road, sees no one coming and goes running up there. And so she gets running up there and she says, oh, my God, look, it's so cute. And she had a blue ribbon in her hair. And she tied this blue ribbon around it. And they threw the kilt down and walked off. So the next morning, the Scotsman comes too. And he did what I did whenever he came to. He went to the nearest pub, ordered up a pint of ale and downed it real quick, and then had to go to the bathroom. So he goes back in the bathroom, he lifts up his kilt, and he sees that blue ribbon. And he says, ah, laddie, I don't know where you've been or whom you've seen, but I'm glad to see you won first prize. And, that's kind of how I lived. I wanted to win first prize. But it's really good to be back in San Antonio. I lived here for a while and transferred out to Phoenix in February. And it's really, really good to be here. I'm a native Texan. I grew up in El Paso, Texas. So if I told you that it was my main ambition in life to grow up, stand behind a lectern, and in front of a group of Alcoholics Anonymous members, I'd be lying. But it wasn't my ambition in life to become an alcoholic. I didn't set out that way. And I used to think that I knew where all of this stuff came from, all the stuff that's in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love the big book because I can see me in it. I can see me now, I can see me as it was, and I can see me as it happened. And for a while it wasn't like that. But I grew up in El Paso, and some people that I know talk about, they can remember the first time they took a drink. I can't remember that. Because I knew as a child, I used to sneak drinks with my cousin out of my uncle's farm. And one story in my house was my brother and I, my dad and his friends would take us to bars and sit us up on the bar stool and give us cigars and a beer. And I don't remember any of that, you know, but that was a big laugh. But I do remember the first time I got drunk. And It was in Juarez, Mexico. I found out about that place real early. And if you live in El Paso, it's just part of the prerequisite, you know. And I remember becoming deathly ill, you know. But the thing that amazes me now as I look backwards at it, I couldn't wait to do it again, you know. The people that don't have my disease, they just go, my God, I'm going to leave this stuff alone. I knew how it made me feel. And up to that point, I really didn't fit in anywhere. But once I started drinking and getting drunk, I fit in anywhere, could do anything, become anybody. It didn't matter. But I was rather talented at playing baseball, and I had an opportunity to play some Major League Baseball and stuff like that. But once I started drinking, that dream became secondary. Now, I look at that now, and how can something be that powerful? You know, because I can remember as a child, that's all I wanted to do, play in the big leagues. That's all I wanted to do, play baseball, play in the big leagues. And then once I started drinking, that became secondary. And anything that got in between that kind of became secondary. Well, I married at an early age and had lost the opportunity to play baseball and ended up getting drafted into the service. Now then, the woman that I married, she didn't drink like I drank. She didn't drink hardly at all. And it was a problem in our marriage. And I couldn't understand that, you know. It didn't make sense to me because I wasn't out fooling around or anything like that. I would go out with the guys and get drunk and come home 2 days later and she'd be upset, you know. I didn't see anything wrong with it, you know, but she didn't like it. But she would leave, and she would come back with the pretense that I wouldn't drink again. And I would make those promises. And I would be sincere whenever I made those promises. I meant it with all my heart and soul, because I really, truly loved her, and I loved my children. Well, I ended up getting drafted and took my draft notice down to the nearest recruiter, the Air Force recruiter, and said, hey, look, I don't want to go to Vietnam. And he says, well, we better sign you up real quick, huh? And went into the Air Force, and you know, they talked about fear whenever I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I don't have any, you know. Well, I can look backwards and realize that fear was the motivator for forever, just about. But it took me a while to see that also. Anyway, I ended up going into the Air Force, and once I got into the Air Force, I found out through a guy that I'd played high school baseball against that he came up to me one day and he says, hey, you want to play softball? And I said, no, I don't want to play softball. The only softball I'd ever seen was old men out on Sunday, you know, with kind of built like Jim. I didn't want any part of that. And he said, no, that's not the way it is. If you try out for this team and you make it, which was the base level team, you can try out for a command team, and then you can try out for the Air Force team. If you make the Air Force team, you go all over the country. You don't have to go to work. You play ball. And that's what I wanted to do. So I tried out, and that happened. And the reason I bring that up is because it was extremely important to me. It kept me out of a lot of trouble, a trouble that I should have gotten into and didn't as a result of playing ball. But to make a long story short, my wife probably left, I don't know, 50 times, 60 times, whatever, I don't know. Like I said, and the pretense was, you drink too much, Gary. And her coming back was always, well, it'll be different, you know, I won't drink. And I really meant that. But see, the time that went on between that, right, was maybe a week, 2 weeks, and I would start looking at her and saying to myself, you know, if you could just accept me the way I am, everything would be okay with us, you know. They talked about resentments whenever I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any of those either. And but the first time I ended up going into any kind of treatment was in 1975 or 1976. I'm really not sure what year, because I didn't really remember being there until 1983, whenever I surrendered to this disease and started following the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started looking backwards throughout my life, trying to figure out where I crossed this so-called magic line. Now, this wasn't a controlled environment, this treatment. It was mostly consisted of group counseling situations and stuff like that. And you'd come in 3 times a week, and every time you come in, they'd say, did you drink? And I'd lie and say, no, you know, and keep on going about my merry way. Because what led me to there was a series of alcohol-related incidents, and the Air Force had gotten tired of slapping me on the wrist, and they put me in this thing. I didn't want to be there. Everybody was glad I was there. My commander was glad I was there. The lady I was married to was glad that I was there. But Gary was not glad that he was there. And I can remember one certain counseling situation, and this guy that was in charge of the group had already told us that he was a recovering alcoholic, and my attitude was, oh, big deal, you know? Who cares, you know? And I was trying to convince him one time that I was a social drinker, and he says, well, hey, Gary, do you know the difference between a social drinker and a potential alcoholic? And I said, well, no, I don't. And he says, well, a social drinker doesn't drink to get drunk, and my immediate reaction was, well, what the hell they drink for, you know? This guy kind of shrugs his shoulders and turned around and walked off, you know. All I wanted to do was get them people off my back and go on about my merry business, and that's what I did. And I really didn't think that anybody knew that I was drinking throughout that time. It was a six-week thing, something like that. Until the lady I was married to finally divorced me, and she pointed back to those times. And I would hide the bottles in my trunk, you know, and drive off to work in the morning and be real nonchalant and everything. And whenever she told me, she says, you know, Gary, you remember that time that you were gonna quit drinking, you were going to get some help, et cetera. And I said, yeah, and I did, you know. And I was looking for the pats on the back and everything. And she says, well, you drank throughout that whole thing. And I said, well, how do you know that? She says, I heard the bottles rattling in your trunk every time you went to work, you know. So see, living the lie, I lied to me, you know, and I didn't understand that for a long time. But living the lie, I lied to me more than anybody else. But I did get the people off my back and went on about my business, and about 4 or 5 years later, ended up in some more trouble. By this time, I'd been up in Alaska. Where that happened was in New Mexico. Been up in Alaska, and now I was in Arizona. The trouble happened up in Alaska, and all the paperwork was catching up with me. And I made a decision between Alaska and Arizona that I wasn't going to drink. I wasn't going to drink, and I wasn't going to play ball. See, because I get around them ball players, you know, and they'd start drinking, and then I'd start drinking. So I wasn't going to play ball. I got in Arizona in April, and last part of March and April is in Gila Bend, Arizona. And I wasn't drinking. And by not drinking, every time that I would not drink, I would look at her and those knuckles would get a little bit tighter, you know. Man, if you could just accept me, you know. And I would leave work, and they were starting to put together a ball team. And I'd leave work, and they were out there practicing, you know, and I'd see them swinging the bat and everything, and that adrenaline would start flowing, and then I go, no, you're not going to play ball, and I'd drive on. And then be mad at her whenever I got home because I wasn't playing ball. And if she could just accept me, everything would be okay. I had a first sergeant there that called me in, and he said, we see here that you played with the Air Force and this and that. We got a pretty good ball club here. We go to tournaments around Phoenix, Yuma, San Diego, Tucson. Would you like to play with us? And I said, no, I think I'm going to quit. You know, I'm not going to play. And so about 2 weeks later, and I remember this distinctly, I went in to work, and I got a phone call from the first sergeant, and he says, you sure you don't want to play ball with us? And I said, well, let me think about it. I'll call you this evening. And I made the decision between that phone call and the time that I got off work, which was around 4 o'clock, that I was going to play. And I can remember the fear in that woman's eyes whenever I told her that I was going to play ball. And I started playing, and I wasn't drinking. And this had been about 4 weeks, 5 weeks, something like that. That's about as long as I could ever last by myself, I tell you. And we would go in a bus, and after the games and stuff, these guys would gather up a case of beer or whatever, and I'd sit up in the front, you know, and they'd say, you want a beer? I'd go, no, you know, I'm not drinking, you know, and all of that. And they'd have a tremendous amount of fun, and I'd sit up in the front just being extremely miserable. And needless to say, I started drinking again. But I also was waiting on this paperwork to catch up with me. The people at Gila Bend didn't know anything about it, but I knew a lot about it. Anyway, it finally did, and they called me in, and they were putting me into treatment once again up at Luke Air Force Base. Well, in between that time, once I started drinking again, this girl that I had married had grabbed the kids and left, and I knew that this time it was for good. I knew that this time it took drastic measures. I knew that this time I was going to have to do something. And I would always take those situations and manipulate them, you know. I call it scheming and dreaming. And so I started scheming and dreaming about how I was going to do this. And once I found out for sure that they were going to put me in, she was back in El Paso with her family, and I called her up and I said, "Hey, look, I'm going to check myself into the alcohol treatment program." And I figured she'd be going, "Oh, great, this is great news." And she goes, "Good," and hung up the phone. And I said, "Oh, man, something's got to change." Well, anyway, I went into this thing, but I went into it open-minded. It was the first time that I'd ever gone into any situation like that open-minded. And I started hearing some things, and they basically talked about alcoholism as a disease. And I understood the disease concept through that. They also showed a film called I'll Quit Tomorrow. Now, I don't know if any of y'all have ever seen it, but I saw it and I could relate with that character a lot because that was me. I was always going to do something about this thing tomorrow. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. But I'd never gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd never considered going to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was one individual that I knew before I'd gotten drafted that had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he would go and get drunk and come back, and I'd say, "Hey, Lon, what was it about?" And he says, "Oh, man, they sit in this church and they pray, you know." Well, I told him what it was about, and he would hose it, you know, and we'd laugh, you know. "Yeah, them stupid fools," you know. It was one of those attitudes. And anyway, in a group counseling situation, I was also scheming and dreaming against the Air Force because I had always gotten outstanding reports, and like I said, playing ball kept me out of a lot of trouble, and it also helped me to know a lot of people in the service because those generals, I tell you, if you're beating the Army, the Navy, and the Marines, you know, you can't do anything wrong, you know, and talk about trouble, those guys. We'd close down clubs, and they'd line out this table and pour beer on it and in these full-dress uniforms, start running as fast as they could and play aircraft carriers so you could slide down the table the farthest. I thought it was great, you know. We tried to do that in the enlisted club. We were in a lot of trouble, you know, but I could get away with it there. But I wanted to at least get out of the service with a good record concern and all of that because I knew that, you know, I could scheme and dream and manipulate that situation to my own better advancement. So anyway, one day in a group counseling situation, once again, there was one guy that was in charge of our group that was a first lieutenant, and he had come through the enlisted ranks, and he'd gotten his commission, and he was driving a Corvette and everything, and right in the middle of the daytime, he goes, "Gary, have you ever thought about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Well, no, I haven't." And automatically, my mind started rolling, scheming and dreaming. And he goes, "Well, would you like to go to one?" And my mind goes, "I'm going to say yes. He's going to say, 'Meet me tonight at 8 o'clock or something like that. I can miss that meeting and lie about it later.'" And so I went, "Yes." And he goes, "Okay, let's go." And I said, "Wait, this isn't in the script, you know." And so that's how I made my first meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went into this room, and there was about 12 grown men sitting around a table. And this guy carried me in, basically, walked in with me. And he sat down next to me, right? And I figured he was going to make sure that I stayed. And they went around the table and introduced themselves. And he introduced himself, and he said that his name, and said that he was an alcoholic. And I can remember looking at him, now wait a minute, he didn't fit my perception of an alcoholic, you know. My perception of an alcoholic was somebody drinking Woolite out of a paper bag or something, you know, down on Skid Row. And I wasn't like that, and this guy sure wasn't like that, you know. And then he told him that I was a newcomer. And this one guy told me, "Oh, we're glad you're here. You're the most important person in the room." Well, I had news for him. I'd figured that out whenever I walked in. Didn't take a genius to look around there and figure out that I was the most important person there. But I tell you, if you have that attitude, it's really hard to stay in recovery. But after I got through with that meeting, you know, I saw that it wasn't all that bad a deal, you know. But I'd heard the first step. And the first step said we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And this thing went out the window because I wasn't powerless over anything. And that if I just applied myself in any given situation, I could always manage it. And that's what I felt concerned in alcoholism also. But scheming and dreaming, once again, I said, well, you better keep going, because then you can call her up and say, now I'm going to AA, and she'll come and beat down the door. And so that's what I did. And once she answered the phone and said, yeah, I'm going to AA now, and she goes, good, and hung up the phone. I said, oh, man. But I heard some things in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, get yourself a big book. I said, what is a big book? And they said, it's a book written by the first 100 men and women as to how they recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I said, oh, okay, fine. And I got it, and I opened it up, and I saw that it was published in 1939. Well, this was 1979. I didn't need any of that stuff, you know. And so I opened it up, and I read the stories in the back, and I thought they'd make great movies, you know. Visions of Days of Wine and Roses came through me, you know. But it wasn't me, and I closed up the book. They also told me to get a sponsor, and I said, well, what's a sponsor? And I don't necessarily agree with this today, but this is what I was told at that time. And they said, it's someone that you can relate to, someone that's taken the 12 steps and applied in their life and can teach you what they've learned. The only thing I don't agree with is someone you can relate to, and I'll get to that, because my sponsor, my original sponsor, I can't relate to him. You know, he makes no sense to me, but he lives sober, and that's what I wanted. You know, so I don't agree with that part. But I said, okay, fine. And there was a guy, he's still in that valley, that at that time had something like 32 years sober, and I figured numbers counted, so I asked him to be my sponsor, and he wouldn't do it. You know, well, that kind of hurt my feelings some, you know. But further on down the road, not long, because I only stayed sober maybe 2 months at the most, he told me I'd made the decision to get out of the service, and he says, Gary, with your attitude, more than likely you go back to drinking again. And boy, that made me mad. And this guy was an older gentleman, you know, so I couldn't really hit him and feel okay about it, you know. And he says, but even if you do, you just keep coming back here. And I said, well, why the hell should I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous if I'm going to drink? And he says, because you can always serve as a bad example, and turned around and walked off, you know. And he was way too old to hit, you know. But see, he understood the disease. And if I would have bothered to read the book, maybe I could have saved myself some misery, because needless to say, I started drinking again. And there's a chapter in that book called More About Alcoholism that says, no one among us likes to admit that he's any different from his fellows. You know, and I thought about that, you know, once I finally surrendered, and I didn't want to admit that I was any different. But it talks about the persistence of that illusion. What illusion? The illusion that I could drink like normal men is astonishing. Many go on to pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. You know, that's the nowhere road if you have this disease called alcoholism. And one of the things that really hit me whenever I finally sobered up was one sentence in there that said we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. And how that came about for me was whenever I went into the VA in Houston, Texas, and like I said, it wasn't my main ambition in life to grow up and become an alcoholic. I went into that VA, and how I got there, I had told somebody that I cared about, that cared about me, my sister, that I thought that I might have a problem and that I needed to do that. And I was trying to get some money from her. And I wanted her to say what all my drinking buddies would say, oh, you don't need to go that far, Gary. You just need to slow down and get away from it for a while and everything will be okay. But she looked me dead in the eye and said, Gary, if that's what you feel you need to do, then you damn sure better do it. So I couldn't back out of it. And I ended up going into the VA, and they took my clothes away and gave me some great big pajamas and a great big robe and foam rubber shoes, and gave me a physical and all of this. And this, if you ever had any dealings with the government whatsoever, it seems like everything takes forever. And they had sent me to this one clinic that's called the Peace Clinic, and I love the acronyms that the government uses, you know. And this one stood for the Primary Evaluating and Admitting Clinic. And I walked in there, and there was two guys there. One guy had been into that VA hospital twice, and another guy had been in there once, and they were both trying to get back in. And I can remember sitting there thinking, going, hey, you just walked off your job to come to something that's not going to work. You better go back to work. You know, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. Nothing's going on. They're not calling these guys. They're not calling me. And I made the decision to leave, and I got up to leave, and they called my name. Now, when I came and surrendered, I used to think, well, when am I going to have one of these spiritual experiences? When's it going to happen, you know? Well, looking at some clarity, there's one there, you know. And I couldn't see that for a while. But anyway, I got into the VA. Like I said, they took my clothes away, and I ended up in this room. And that's where I started looking backwards. Where did I cross this line, you know? And I'm sitting in that room, and this rather large black female nurse with a voice deeper than mine, arms bigger than mine, came in and says, you're going to a meeting. And I said, I'll go anywhere you want me to go. You know, you just point the way. So I went to the day room there in the detox ward. And see, I'd been to those AA meetings before, so I sat in the middle, you know, because if you sat in the back, they really kind of pointed at you. And if you sat up front, they kind of talked to you. And I figured if I got in the middle, everything would be okay. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw this guy come in with these big, thick Coke bottle glasses and this bald head. And he had a big grin on his face, and he was smoking Pall Mall after Pall Mall. And I thought he was from the psych ward, and he ended up chairing the meeting. You know? Which says a lot for our fellowship, right? But he said something that night that really just hit home with me. He said, there's nobody in this room that ever has to live that way again if they choose not to. All they have to do is be willing to pick up the kit of spiritual tools that Alcoholics Anonymous offers, apply them in their life, and they don't have to go back to that way of life. Now, I don't remember a lot else that he said, but I remember that. And in Houston, they call for desire chips at the end of the meeting. And so they call for desire chips. And I sat there thinking, you know, you need to go get one. And then the next thought that came through there was, yeah, but what will people think, you know? No, you need to go get one, but what will people think, you know? And as I'm, what will people think, looking around the room, I glanced and I saw those foam rubber shoes. I said, wait, it's a little too late, you know? And you got foam rubber shoes on. So I went and got a desire chip. And now, getting back to conceited to my innermost self, that's where that came about with this individual. That individual, George P., became my sponsor in Houston, Texas. I couldn't relate to him. I was raised in the South, and I was also raised that anybody north of the Red River should have been dead a long time ago. And I did everything I could to speed that process along, you know. This guy's from the Bronx, you know, so this is what kind of sense of humor my God has, you know. He was 58 years old at that time, but he'd been sober 9 years. And after that meeting, I was talking to him some, and he goes, Gary, three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. He says, do you believe you're an alcoholic? And I said, well, yeah, I do. And he says, are you saying that from somewhere up between your ears? Or are you saying that from down in your heart? And I said, well, I'm saying it from down in my heart because everything just hasn't worked. And he says, oh, that's great news. And that wasn't great news to me. I said, what do you mean? And he says, see, you don't understand. Our book says that we have to concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. He says, the great news follows as it says, this is the first step in recovery. He says, see, the moment you do that, you begin a process of recovery. Now, how far you want to take it, that's entirely up to you, and that's what these steps are designed for. And then he goes, B, that probably no human power could have relieved their alcoholism. He says, you ever try to stay sober for a woman? Now, you got to understand, I just met this guy. I didn't know, you know, such clairvoyance, you know. And I said, well, yeah. And he says, you ever have any kids? And I said, yeah. And he said, you try to stay sober for them? I said, yeah. He says, you ever surround yourself with people that didn't drink like you and try to be like them? And I said, well, yeah. He said, did it work? And I said, no. He says, see, it's all human powers. They can't help you. And then he goes, see, that God could and would if he were sought. And I just kind of shuddered. I've heard a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous say that whenever they got in trouble, they called out, get me out of this, God, and I won't do this again. I never did that. I started scheming and dreaming. What do I got to do to get out of this? You know, I'd left God at an early age, and I didn't want nothing to do with him, you know. And as far as I was concerned, he didn't want anything to do with me. And so I just kind of shuddered, and he says, hold it, Gary. Our second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. He said, if you're fortunate enough to hang around here long enough, there's a pretty good chance that you, too, will come to believe. And so that was enough at that moment, you know. That's all I needed to hear. And he says, why don't you go read this chapter in our book called We Agnostics? He says, do you have that book? And I said, well, yeah, I got it. And so I had to call my sister, and I said, hey, look, in the bottom of my duffel bag, you know, there's a blue book. Don't look at it. Just bring it to me, you know. And so she did. And I started reading We Agnostics, and it still wasn't making any sense, you know. It was like sonar, you know, just everything bouncing off the pages, nothing hitting home. And after about 3 days, 4 days in the VA, he would come up in the detox ward and see me every day. And we would talk about this thing, you know, and he would always talk about, never in your wildest dreams, Gary, can you believe what sobriety will bring? And stuff like that. And I'm going, man, this old dude is really crazy, you know. I said, but there's something there. Like I said, I could sense the life from that individual. And you've met him in Alcoholics Anonymous. You meet him all the time. And but I couldn't pinpoint it. I didn't know what it was. But I knew that I wanted to find out more. And so I was telling him, after they gave me back my clothes after about 4 or 5 days, I was saying, I'm not real sure about this God thing. You know, I've been reading that book, that We Agnostics, and it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't even know what an agnostic is, you know. He says, well, don't worry about it. He says, do you believe the sun came up today? And I said, well, yeah. He says, you believe it's going to set this evening? And I said, well, yeah. He says, did you have anything to do with it? And I said, well, no. He says, well, if it's happening and you didn't have anything to do with it, then there's got to be a power greater than you in the universe. You agree or disagree? And I went, but, he says, real simple. Do you agree or disagree? And I said, well, I can agree with that. And he says, just hold on to that. And so I started thinking about whatever was bringing that sun up and whatever's making it go down, you know. I need some help. And where we had to eat was pretty close to this chapel, right? And so I go walk into the chapel and make sure that nobody sees me whatsoever. And I go in and I sit down on a pew. And I'd say, hey, look, I've heard if a guy's hurting and he's wanting, that you'll help him. Well, I'm hurting and I'm wanting, and I'm out of here. And that's basically how it was. And I would get out of there. And it was okay first 4, 5, 6 days. You know, they had me in this detox ward, and everything would be okay, right, as long as I was in that detox ward. But there was a part of me knowing that I was going to have to leave this detox ward someday. And I was voicing those concerns with George, and he says, don't worry about it, you know. Just stay away from the drink one day at a time. I said, George, I don't understand. I'm not sure if I can do that. And he says, well, let me tell you something, Gary. They got these research centers throughout the country. He says, they got monkeys in these research centers. He says, they feed them booze and drugs for every day of their life. And he says, and then they take them off the booze and drugs, and just to see what's going to happen to them. And he says, and you know what happens? And I thought he was going to give me some great scientific discovery. And I said, well, what? He says, even the damn monkeys make it a day. And I said, oh, I'm not a monkey. You know, and that got me angry enough to say, okay, all right. And he says, just don't forget the first drink gets you drunk. And when he first told me that, I said, what are you talking about? He says, don't forget, the first drink gets you drunk. And I said, no, I can take a drink and not get drunk. He says, if you really believe that, he says, what you ought to do is go down here in South Houston where these freight yards are. He says, make sure you go on a full moon night, about midnight and everything, and go out there to where these trains are coming in and out. He says, find yourself a track and straddle that track. Make sure that you can see the moonlight shining off the track, and wait for a train to come along. He says, watch that headlight going round and round and round and round and round. He says, watch it all the way until it hits you and see if you give a shit what the caboose does. And I said, oh, yeah. Yeah, I gotcha. He says, see, the moment you take that drink, you set up this compulsion and you go again. And I said, oh, okay, I got that. So one night, after I was in the VA about 7 days, I was reading that chapter, We Agnostics. Like I said, it was sonar, nothing making sense. And I came to the end of that chapter where a guy had the same attitude that I had, that if God really did exist, the world wouldn't be in the shape that it is, I wouldn't be where I was at, so on and so on and so on. And this guy was in a sanitarium once again for the disease called alcoholism. And a guy from this fellowship came to see him, and he basically ran that guy off, told him, look, I don't want to hear anything you got to say, just go on. And so that guy left. This guy goes back to his room, and he was laying in his bed thinking about how could all the people in this world be wrong about God, and he knew all the answers, right? And then the thought came to him, who are you to say there is no God? And the moment I read it that night, and the moment I talk about it today, something happened to me, and I knew that there was something more here than not drinking. And I couldn't believe it. I started talking to my sponsor about it. And he says, yeah, Gary, you know it's italicized. And I said, well, yeah. And he says, it's real important when something's italicized in that book. You know? He says, when they put it in the first person, they're talking to you. And I, oh, yeah, okay. And so I started trying to study a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. I ended up getting out of that VA hospital, and I had to lie to get a job. And anyway, I got this job, and the lie caught up with me, and I ended up losing it. And I went into a great deal of self-pity. Well, I hadn't taken the fourth step of this program. I'd heard all kinds of different conceptions concerning the fourth step. I'd heard all kinds of different guides concerning the fourth step. And I had a lot of preconceived notions concerning the fourth step. And basically, my preconceived notion was that it was a fearful, immoral inventory. And I thought that you just write down all the bad stuff that you've ever done in your life and give it to somebody for a fifth step and everything's okay after that. Well, I wasn't going to tell anybody the stuff I've done in my life. Forget that, you know. I sure wasn't going to write it down. You know, so see, I had a lot of misconceptions about the fourth step. And I would hear, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do this, you got to do that. Well, I went into this self-pity, and I was in a lot of self-pity. You know, I thought that I'd worked in the electrical career field, and I didn't want to go back to doing line work because all the linemen that I'd ever been around were like me. They carried guns, they did drugs, they drank like I drank, and I didn't want to go back into that situation. Well, I come to find out that I manipulated those situations to get to people that drank like I did drugs, and carried guns. But it took going through this portion to get to that. Because I loved being outside, and I loved the work. It was physical, you know, and you get up there, nobody bothers you. If somebody's yelling at you from the ground, you just kind of act like you can't hear them, and they go on eventually, you know, because they're not going to come up there. So I liked that work. But I didn't want to go back to it. I had a fear about that. Well, my God has shown me that I don't need to fear. You know, that he loves me more than I can love myself, basically, and he wants me to have the very best. But it took going through these situations to do that, and one of them was concerning the fourth step. Well, in that self-pity situation, I was in a meeting one night, and I was complaining about not getting a job. See, I was doing everything I thought I knew how to do, which was read the want ads and go to the TEC, the Employment Commission. And after the meeting, George comes up to me, he taps me on the shoulder, and he says, hey, Gary, I heard you complaining about this. He says, you know, I know you well enough to know that you told me you work in the electrical career field. He says, are you doing everything you can to get a job? And I said, well, yeah, I am. See, I'm going to TEC, I'm reading the want ads, nothing's going on, you know. And he says, well, I tell you, I know for a fact that in the Houston Yellow Pages, there's probably this many pages full of electrical contractors. Have you gone to any of them? You know, and I said, well, no. He says, well, don't tell me you're doing everything you can to get a job. You know, and so that made me mad. And I said, I'll show this old, you know, da, da, da. And as he walked away, he says, three printed ideas, Gary, pray about it. Don't forget, God is or he isn't. And if he is, he's everything. If he isn't, he's nothing. What's your choice going to be today? Okay, George, he is, you know, and he'd go on about his business. So I prayed about it, you know. And then I called him up and I said, you know, George, I think I need to do this four step. And he says, well, come on over and let's talk about the four step. And so I went over there and I was ready to write down all the bad stuff I'd ever done throughout my life. And he goes, wait, let's see what the step says. It says, made of searching and fearless. See, I get confused now. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. He says, do you understand what that means? And I said, well, yeah, you write down all the bad stuff that you've ever done. And he says, no, it doesn't say that. And I said, besides, you know, and I wouldn't let him finish. I'm going, and besides, what guide do I need to get, you know, and this and that. And he stopped everything and he goes, Gary, did you read the book? And I said, the book? And he says, yeah, the book. Did you read the book concerning the fourth step of this program? And I said, well, no, I didn't do that. And he says, why don't you read the book? And first of all, why don't you go look up the word moral and try to understand what fearless is. And if you can't do a fearless one, look back at the third step. So I did. I looked back at the third step, and he once again, he says, it begins after three pertinent ideas. You ought to know where that is. And so I went to the book. It said, being convinced we were at step three. And then it told me some reasons why I wanted to do step three, you know, and it basically was talking about selfishness. Well, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't a selfish person. You know, you people made me selfish, you know, and, you know, my attitude was, I'll give you the shirt off my back, but see, you better not ever forget it now, because now you owe me, you know, and I couldn't understand that as selfishness until I started really understanding what the third step had to say. Well, anyway, it finally came down in the fourth step of this program that I could understand it. After praying for understanding, after getting back with my sponsor, and it was the greatest learning experience that I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous to this day, you know, because it gave me something to work with, you know, it gave me ability to recognize things that can go on in me today that'll keep me from doing any kind of God's will whatsoever. And what I mean, it says to list our resentments and what causes that resentment and what it affected inside of me, you know. What were they talking about, you know? Well, by praying about it, by talking with my sponsor, I come to understand what that was, you know. I could see where the fear was. I could see where the pride was. I could see where the ego was affected. And see, any time that that became affected, I cut myself off from God, just like that. And so then it told me what to do with those resentments, you know. It said that we quit looking at the other person's fault, we look at our fault. You know, what part did we play in it? If we could find no part of our own in this situation, then we look at these people as perhaps spiritually sick. Well, see, I know what it feels like to be spiritually sick. I lived that way for a long, long time. But after I read that, who are you to say there is no God, something began to happen inside of me. And that hole began to get filled. And I don't want to go back to the way that I felt prior to that time. And I don't wish that upon anybody. Not today. Not today at all. Whether they're in this program or out of this program. And so see, whenever I can look at somebody as perhaps spiritually sick, then I can do what the rest of that says, to grant them the same kindness, tolerance, and pity that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When I write in the middle of it, that's real hard to do. But if I remember it, you know, because I got a tool to work with, it comes real easy. Then it told me to list my fears, even if I had no resentment involved with it. Well, prior to that time, I didn't think that I had any fear until I started writing it down on paper, and then I could see, like I said, my whole life had been motivated by fear. And my sponsor always talks about you can't live in fear and faith. You know, they don't exist together. You either have one or the other. Either God is or he isn't. And See, the book gave me a solution concerning that, you know. Why do we got these things? Isn't it true that we trust our own finite selves rather than an infinite God? You know, then it says we ask God to remove our fear and show him, have him show us what he would have us be. It says then, at once, we commence to outgrow fear. It doesn't say it's going to go away, but it says that I can outgrow fear. And any time it comes about, then I got a solution. I say, hey, God, remove this fear. Show me what you want me to do. Let's go forward. You know, and then it told me to list, to do a sexual inventory, and not who I slept with or what I slept with, but take those situations, right? And see where I unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, bitterness, you know, anger. What should I have done instead? Well, it was real evident to me by the time I was doing this sexual inventory that I shouldn't have been there in the first place. But see, if I just stopped right there, then I'd browbeat myself. The book gives me a solution concerning that, because it says, by putting this down on paper and looking at this, then I come up with an ideal. And then I ask God to help mold this ideal, you know. And I've experienced that ideal, and that's well worth it. Now, if I step out of it, driven by self, once again, then I shortchange myself to what God wants for me and what this program is teaching me on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, I'm a human being, and I step out, you know, but then I pay the consequences inside because it hurts inside. And wasn't always that way. Whenever I first came to this program, my sponsor said, greet the newcomers. And if she was a newcomer, I was greeting her, you know. And he took me to another portion of that book at the end of that. And it says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into working with others. This seems to quiet the imperious urge, you know. And I can still see his eyebrows crinkling, you know. That when to yield would mean heartache. And he goes, Gary, let me tell you something. When it says when to yield would mean heartache, they're not necessarily talking about you, you know? And, boy, I wish he would have never told me that. But he did. But that ideal was well worth it. And then I also heard in meetings that if you didn't take the fourth step, you were going to get drunk. And I'm not sure if that's true or not, you know? I do know that it says that about the fifth step. It says that time after time, newcomers have tried to hold on to certain ideas about themselves. Almost invariably, they got drunk. There were some things in my fifth step that I wasn't going to share with my sponsor. I wasn't going to share with anybody. And right before, he called me up and he says, Gary, read the book. Come on over. And so I read that, you know, but I still wasn't going to tell him. And as it started, he started talking about himself, and he really helped me. Because then I could see that I wasn't that unique, that if I wanted to carry this around for the rest of my life, I had that opportunity to do. But here was a chance to get rid of it, you know. And by that time, I feel that God had restored me to some sort of sanity, and I wanted to get rid of it. And so I did. And then he says, go read what the book says concerning the fifth step afterwards. So I did, and I did what it said, you know, to find myself a quiet time. And to look back on those first five proposals, because what I was doing was building an archway to freedom. And I don't know about you, but that's what I wanted. I wanted that archway to freedom, because I'd experienced that. George had shown me that. His sponsor, Dick S., had shown me that. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to live in the misery ever again. And then looking at the sixth and the seventh step, you know, I've heard those called the forgotten steps, and I know in my own recovery I've forgotten a lot about them, you know, because I didn't, you know, whenever I first saw them, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Well, see, going back to some sort of sanity, the defects of character were the things that were keeping me from this sunlight, so why wouldn't I want to be rid of them? You know, well, they're, like it says in our 12 and 12, there was a lot of them that I held on to that I wasn't real comfortable in. And I didn't want to lose them because I was afraid I'd become a missionary or whatever, you know, and I didn't want that. You know, I'm come walking up to everybody, those Jesus freaks in the airport, you know, and Hare Krishna. I couldn't see myself doing that. And I was really afraid that would be happening to me. Anyway, after discussion with my sponsor and really trying to understand what it said, and whenever he said, we're entirely ready, like it says in the 12 and 12, that those were the key words. You know, am I willing to have God take me to better things? You know, that's the key for me. And so then to humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And see, I got to do those things today still, you know, because being cognizant of a defect of character doesn't mean recovery for me. You know, am I willing to see the other side? And I heard this speaker say this one time, and it made so much sense to me. He says, he said that he felt that God let us hold on to some of those things just to see the other side, you know? And see, by applying these 12 steps in my life and letting you people love me, I've come to experience serenity. One of the promises says we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. Well, I comprehend the word serenity. I know what it feels like and I know what it lives like. And I like it a lot. I got a picture of a clear mountain lake in my head that's really nice up in the mountains, and that's my serenity zone. And because I looked it up once and it said calm and undisturbed, a definition, one of the definitions that really hit me. And so see, I can stand up on the side and take in the calm and undisturbed, or I can stand up on the side and throw rocks in and create a disturbance. But as long as I quit throwing the rocks, the disturbance will go away. You know, or an external force can come along and create a disturbance. But as long as that changes, it goes back to its original state, calm and undisturbed. And so, see, I know what that feels like inside. And this guy explained it like this. He said, how did I ever know the virtues of tolerance rather than from being intolerant? See, when I'm intolerant, that serenity zone isn't there. It's gone. You know, but whenever I'm tolerant, it's there. It stays. And so I've learned it that way, same way with patience. How did I ever learn the virtues of patience rather than from being impatient? And I used to be one of those people that stood in lines, and I hated it. I'd get up there finally and give the person that was behind the counter or whatever a hard time because I had to stand in the line, you know. And I wasn't selfish, you understand. But but now it's kind of neat because you stand there and so what? The big, you know, what's going to happen today? I look at things like this. My grandfather's 87 years old. And if I'm fortunate enough to live as long as he has, then what's the big deal about today? And so by the time I get there, it's kind of nice to go, hi, how you doing? You having a good day? Looks like you're pretty hectic, you know, or whatever, just to give some kind of kindness. Because, see, that's what you people taught me, you know. That isn't Gary Jackson. That you people loving him through this spirit that I call God. And so the eighth and the ninth steps came about, right? Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Well, there's some people that I harmed that I wasn't really willing to meet them or to see them and admit my wrong. And I thought that a man was saying sorry, and my sponsor goes, have you looked the word up, Gary? And I said, no, I haven't looked the word up. And he says, why don't you look it up, you know? Maybe it'll help you. So I looked it up, and it said one of the definitions that made sense to me was to right a wrong. So see, any time that I'm going into that situation, I'm trying to right the wrong that I committed and try to become at peace with another member of this human race. But there were still some people that I didn't want to meet. Anyway, about... oh, I don't know, 5 years ago, I guess, something like that. I was down in Houston. This is after I moved to San Antonio. And I was down in Houston, and I'd gone to see my sponsor, and we were talking, and he had gone back up to the Bronx, and he was talking about he had an opportunity before, years before, to make amends to this one guy, and he let the fear keep him from going over there and making the amends, and he neglected that amend. Anyway, he went back up there specifically to satisfy that amend, and... this guy was dead. He didn't have that opportunity. And he was talking about the emptiness that he felt inside concerning that, you know. And I was going to El Paso. I went to El Paso. That's where my parents used to live. And coming back on a Sunday, something like that, I needed to get some more cash, and I went down to the bank machine, and my card wouldn't work. And before I'd gotten drafted, there was an individual in Deming, New Mexico, that I'd stolen a lot of money from that I'd worked for. And he caught me, and He should have fired me. That's what I would have done. But he didn't do that. He arranged the schedule with me in order for me to pay back that money that I'd stolen. And I got drafted, and I never paid him back a cent. You know, but I never forgot about it. And anyway, I went back home, and on this Sunday, I'm trying to get some money, and my bank card won't work. And so I go back to my dad's, and I say, hey, can I write you a check? And he says, well, I don't have any cash with me. And he doesn't have a bank card, and he says, I don't know what you're going to do. And he says, oh, but wait, I know what you can do. Bill Dawson is running this place down here. Bill Dawson's the guy that I owe this amends to, you know. And this is after my sponsor telling me all this stuff about having that opportunity and all that. And I was thinking about it all the way down there. And I wanted to say, ah, Dad, let's go somewhere else, you know. I can figure out something else. But I didn't do that, you know, because of what he had told me and how much it hurt him inside and how empty it felt inside. So anyway, we go in, and it had been like 12, 14 years since I'd seen Bill. And he comes out, and he's all happy to see me and everything. And he says, let's go get some coffee. And I said, well, Bill, can we go in your office? I need to talk to you. And he says, sure. So we go in there, and I said, you remember this? And he'd forgotten completely about it. And he goes, well, now that you bring it up, yeah, okay. And he says, and I said to him, I was supposed to pay you back some money, and I never did. He says, you didn't pay me back, you know? And I said, no, I didn't, you know? I was going. But anyway, I said, I need to pay you back, you know? Work something out to where I can pay you back. And he goes, oh, no, let's forget it. And I said, no, Bill, you don't understand. See, I need to pay it back because it's how I live today. And he says, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, been sober for a while, and this is what I need to do to keep going forward. Well, he's familiar with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because his brothers tried to get this for a long, long time. And he couldn't admit that powerlessness. And he died from this disease. And so he was well aware of what Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to do. So anyway, we arranged something and all of this, and I'd forgotten completely about asking him to cash a check. And so we were walking out, going to get some coffee, right? And I said, oh, yeah, Bill, can you cash a check for me? And he looks over at my dad, and he goes, this guy's check's any good? And he goes, they are today, you know? And so, see, that was worth it. That was worth it, just to hear that from my father. And then the 10th step, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I used to think that that meant before I went to bed, I reviewed my day, and if I did anything wrong, then I tried to make up for it the next day. Well, I was talking about that with my sponsor one night, and he goes, did you read the book? And I said, well, no, I didn't read the book. And so I went and read the book. And the book talks about that this is a lifetime process, this inventory stuff. But it says the moment that I see or recognize these things, fear, anger, jealousy, envy, lust, whatever it is, that I immediately ask God to remove it and discuss it with someone immediately, you know? That amazed me, you know? Heck, man, here I'm living through it all day long, you know? And here I can have a solution like this, just like that, the moment I recognize, hey, God, I don't like this. Take it away. You know, let's go forward. And then when I get a chance with someone that's familiar with the fellowship and recovery, I talk about it. It's usually at a meeting. But the 11th step, my sponsor really kind of drilled this one home in me because it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. I really didn't understand the 11th step too much. You know, I tried to get some meditation things going, and I would lose them, you know, and I kept thinking of not Hare Krishnas, but the yogas and all of that stuff, you know, and I'd try to get those ums going, you know, but they would stop, you know. Something would jump in my head. And so by looking at, also I was looking at my day to see if I'd done anything wrong. So see, I wasn't constructively reviewing my day. That's what the book says to do. Constructively, I was destructively reviewing my day. There's a big difference there if you've ever experienced it. But my sponsor said, Gary, let's look at what the step says. And he says, first of all, you know, do you believe that God's restored you any sanity? And I said, well, yeah. He says, did he take away the desire to drink? And I said, well, yeah. He says, was that a good thing? And I said, well, yeah. And he says, well, don't you think a sane person would want to improve upon something that's good? And I said, well, yeah. And he says, well, let's look at what the 11th step says, because that's what it's given you an opportunity to do, to improve upon something that's good. And it has been that way. You know, it tells you in the mornings that we look forward to these days, something like that. But it says that we ask him for an intuitive thought or decision. You know, have him show us what he'll have us be, you know. When I'm there, that's a real, real good space, you know. And I've experienced that, so that's what I try to do. And I like it a whole lot. And then the 12th step, I don't have enough time to talk about the 12th step. having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, my sponsor went, hey, Gary, they're talking about the first 11. Can you believe that? And I said, well, yeah, you know, as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I can remember early in sobriety, some guys that I would hang out with in the VA hospital, we would go to this all-night coffee place and give the waitress a bunch of heck, you know, give her a hard time. And one night he goes, you know, Gary, there's a lot of people that have gone before you. And he says, you're sitting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, the moment that you start sitting sober, doesn't matter if you're here a day, if you're here 1,000 days or a million days, he says, you accept that responsibility of the people that have gone before you. And there's certain principles that go along with that. And I'm going, well, what are the principles? You know, and he's going, well, you don't need to know them if you've got to ask me what they are. He says, but you got to understand, too, that if you're going over to this place, this diner, and giving these waitresses a hard time, how did he know we was doing that? You know, that clairvoyance jumped back in there, you know. I sure didn't tell him. And he says, but you have that responsibility, because, see, you don't know if that girl is ever going to need what we have to offer, or if somebody in her family needs what we have to offer. And if all she knows of Alcoholics Anonymous is there are a bunch of jerks that sit around in my coffee shop and give me a hard time all night, she's not going to want what we got to offer. And so I've come to understand that those principles are in the book. It says love, tolerance, and kindness. Can I do that with everybody? This book says that that's my code to live by. That's real hard to do, you know, because Gary's self wants to get in there and justify the situation and say, hey, no, I'm better than this, I'm better than that, I'm better than this. But when it comes right down to it, I'm a drunk that's been given the grace to stay sober one day at a time. And thank God it was written down, you know. Whenever I start doubting the presence of this power greater than myself, I start thinking of how this thing came about. And if you know anything about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy named Roland that sought out a psychiatrist. There was three world-known psychiatrists at the time, and one of them was Carl Jung. And it's amazing that he was the only one of those three psychiatrists that would utilize a spiritual approach. And Roland ended up going to him, and Carl Jung basically told him that he really couldn't help him. He had seen cases like his recover, but they came through the spiritual angle, and he couldn't explain it. And Roland told him, well, he was a good member of the church and this and that, and he says, that's not enough. It's got to be more. Anyway, that led Roland to the Oxford groups. And the Oxford groups led Roland to Ebby, and Ebby led to Bill W. in 1934 in New York City. And from Bill W. to October 11th, 1991, with this room here, that's where this thing has gone. And it's all as a direct result of the 12th step of this program. Our new trustee is with us this weekend, and I haven't had the opportunity to meet her, but the one that she that preceded her, Jan W., I knew really, really well. And that lady taught me how to live. People in Alcoholics Anonymous have taught me how to live, but her especially, she loved loved life. And she died last November in a car wreck. And I was talking with David D. from Rockport earlier today. And just this past year, a lot of people that have been real important to me in my sobriety have passed away. Pete and Kay Maroney in Houston. Kay had 29 years. She was one of the persons that started the VA meeting there in Houston. And Pete, he finally had 13, and he would go in and out, in and out, in and out. But he died with 13 years sober. They meant a whole lot to me. They still do. And hopefully I can carry on some of the things that they've done. Larry Y., I get the flyer from Tom, right? And I open it up, and it says the first annual memorial golf tourney, you know, Larry Y. And I'm going, oh, my God. Larry died, and nobody even called me to tell me, man. You know? So I called up Duncan and found out that he was still alive, which was good to know. Most of the time. 4 years ago, I'm gonna share this story with you, and then I'm going to get out of here. About 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, Larry was our delegate. And he got to go to New York to the GSO and everything, and to the General Service Conference. And this one girl that we knew, her husband was having a birthday party for her. It was her naked birthday. And he'd have this thing every year, and they'd have these games and all of this, and you'd get all these dollars, and then they'd have this auction at the end of the night, and it was a lot of fun. And Larry had just gotten back from the General Service Conference, and he got to go to Stepping Stones, where Bill and Lois lived, and Lois was still alive at that time, and he got his picture taken with Lois, and she signed his big book and stuff, and he was telling me about this at that party. And at that time, I was traveling here in San Antonio in my job, going all over the place. And I said to him, I said, you know, Larry, that really sounds like a great trip. I sure hope I get to go up there sometime. And 2 weeks later, I was up in Oklahoma City. And there's a three-day weekend coming up, and I've got all these plans about what I'm going to do on this three-day weekend. And my boss calls from San Antonio, and he goes, Gary, you got to finish up by Friday. And I said, well, why? He says, because I'm going to send you up to New York City for this symposium on Monday, you know. And I said, oh, okay. And so I hung up the phone, and the immediate thought that came to my head was, well, they said watch what you pray for, but they never said about watch what you say, you know. And so I ended up going up to New York City, and it was great. I finished what I had to do the first day I was there as far as business. The rest of the time I spent at tourist, you know, and I went to GSO. And as I rode the elevator, I didn't know it was on the second floor. It was in the old Flatiron building. If any of y'all have seen some of those pictures, you know what building I'm talking about. The moment I saw it, I knew where it was. I also went by the 23rd Street Clubhouse, the first clubhouse in New York City, and went by where Towns Hospital was. It was really, really neat for me. But anyway, I go walking. I rode it up the elevator, and I asked the guy, I said, where's AA, GSO? And he goes, oh, second floor, you know. And I felt kind of bad about riding the elevator, but I got off the elevator, and there's this couple walking in front of me. And we ended up, we're going into the same place. And they go in first, and this lady behind the desk says, can I help you? And he goes, my name's Arlen, I'm from Scotland, you know, and she looks at me, I'm Gary, I'm from Texas, and so she says, we don't have time to help you right now, but you guys come in here and sit down, and there's the coffee, and we'll be with you as soon as we can. Well, that was really, really special, because it was like we had known each other our whole lives, you know. It was great. And since that time, we've been corresponding, and any time I really need a spiritual lift, I'll get a letter from Alan, and he's a journalist, and they're the most spiritual letters that I've ever received in my life. And it not only lifts me up, but it puts me back in focus, you know, because I get to share some recovery across the aisles. And it's the same thing there as it is here. One drunk talking to another drunk with love and to keep going forward. 2 years ago, I got to go to Greece, and I ended up at Heraklion on the island of Crete. I got there. There was no meetings. And see, my God, he knows what Gary needs. He knows that beyond a shadow of a doubt. And I ran into a guy that was here in the States, and he had only gotten at the most 30 days sober, and he would get drunk, you know. And so we spent a lot of times together. And whenever I left, he wanted to start a meeting there on Heraklion. And so I got back and I sent him a bunch of stuff. And we corresponded for a little while, and then I never heard anything from him. And so I kept writing, didn't hear anything, and so I'd basically kind of given up on him. Right before I transferred out to Phoenix, I received a letter in the mail, and it was from him. And all the letters before, it was just this guy and his wife at this meeting. And I opened up this letter, and he started talking about how the meeting had grown from him and his wife. His wife's not an alcoholic, but just him and his wife to over 19 people, you know. And this guy's, they've had two children in that time, you know, and just the joy that came about in that letter. You know, I got to experience that. And if I would have walked away, you know, with that same attitude, that bad attitude, I would have missed all that, and I would have missed this. And I'll be eternally grateful for even being here. And I thank you for letting me share, and I hope each and every one of you have a great weekend, because I plan on doing that. Thanks.